Thanks very much, Sabuti. I thought I'd begin by just saying a little bit about how this retreat came about. Sometime last year, I was up at in Sabuti's and Sri Mala's Pure Land, my squin in near Bulla in Wales, and it was a small retreat. A buyer was there to talk a bit about. I don't think anybody else here was on that retreat, but we were there to talk about what we were going to do at Adishtana, or come up with ideas about what sort of retreats that we would do. Particularly, we were concerned about how we would obviously pass on Bhante's Dharma legacy, his legacy to us. We had lots of different discussions, and I remember very vividly one afternoon, it was very sunny, quite warm, we were sitting out by the stream and the pond under the tree, and we were going round about, you know, trying to sort of understand, or you know, what we were trying to do, understand Bhante. And there was a certain point Sabuti was really sort of groping for something, and he suddenly said, "The thing is, I love Bhante, and that doesn't mean that I always like him. I love Bhante. Something has happened in my communication with him, in my friendship with him, and I love him." And I think at that moment I knew exactly what he was talking about. There was a charge, if you like, between Sabuti and I. And I don't know if it was on that retreat, but I mentioned something that Sabuti had told me about, which Bhante had told him about. Lovely little lineage there. That Lama Govinda had said about the Kalyanamitra. Kalyanamitra, particularly in the context of the Vajrayana, in the relationship between the guru and the chela, the guru and the disciple. Lama Govinda says that what characterized that relationship is the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. The flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. I'm going to say a bit more about that phrase a little bit later on, but we talked about that, Sangharakshita as, Bhante as, the, or his communication with people as this flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros, just as a sort of shorthand and probably a sort of a dumbing down of the meaning of the phrase. But it's a phrase probably, I think, from Neoplatonism, or certainly Gnosticism, and it's the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros is the creation of the cosmos out of love, the creation of a cosmos out of love. So Lama Govinda saying that is what happens in Kalyanamitrata. A bit more about that later. And then a bit later on, we were doing a retreat at Padmaloka, this retreat where Sabuti gave a series of talks on Sangharakshita's system of spiritual practice, spiritual life. And we were having breakfast every morning, Sabuti and I, talking about the retreat, and Sabuti talking about what he was going to be talking about and reflecting on and all sorts of other things. And I was sort of feeding him bits and pieces from my own reading, particularly from Sufi tradition and so on, just sort of, you know, lobbing it in sort of thing. And as I was sparked off, and it was just before Sabuti was going to give a talk on what was called at one time spiritual receptivity, but he talked it more in terms of dharmic responsiveness. And he started to talk about that in terms of eros. I remember the moment when Sabuti says, "I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about this response in terms of the erotic, in terms of eros." Which I was slightly horrified by at the time. I thought, "Well, hang on." But it was a really wonderful moment. But then he went even further. He said, "I know, we're going to do a retreat together next year, Adishtana, Eros and Beauty in the Dharma Life. That's what we're going to do." And again, I was slightly horrified. But Sabuti isn't somebody to when the erotic is upon him, you don't. You just go with it, you roll with it. So that's a bit about how this retreat came about. We've just had 3 days up at my squin, kind of talking about what we were going to do, and I've been gathering materials as well from different things that Bhante has said. So I'm going to talk first personally about my own encounters with Bhante. When I first met Bhante when I was 17 or 18, something like that. I first came along when I was 17, and I was living in the then Brighton Buddhist Centre community, a very different, quite different place from now. Tiny terraced buildings up in Kemp Town, those of you who know Brighton, with a tiny living room. And Bhante came to see what Buddhadasa had done, because Buddhadasa had started this centre. It was one of the first centres, I think, after the centre in Archway in North London. There was Glasgow, and I think New Zealand things had started, and then there was Brighton. And I was incredibly excited that Bhante was coming, because as far as I was concerned, Bhante was my guru. I'd never met Bhante, but I'd heard all the reel-to-reel tape lectures, as they were in those days, read everything I could, which wasn't much. Bhante was coming. He was my teacher. In some ways, it was quite deflating at first, perhaps inevitably, given the excitement of an adolescent 17, 18-year-old Bhante coming in a rather sort of shabby Mac, long, greasy hair, probably not as long as you met him, no rings. And I went over to him to gush, and he sort of held my hand and looked away from me and said, "Hello." That was my first meeting with my guru, which was something I had to get used to over the years. But there was another moment which, you've probably heard some of these stories before, but they're important to me. So one morning I was on my own with Bhante in this tiny room, and he was sitting there in this chair with a sort of tweedy jacket on, his long greasy hair, these sort of weird bent glasses that look so kind of stuck together. I think they're quite trendy, those glasses now, but not then. He wore these great big sort of boots as well, I seem to remember, and these sort of brown sort of trousers and a kind of stained jumper and so on. And he was just sitting there. And he didn't put me at my ease. He didn't make conversation. I asked him if he wanted tea, and he said, "Yes." And I was just sort of sitting there, and I didn't know what to say. I thought, well, just look at him. He's your guru, you know. And he was just looking straight ahead. You know, there was absolutely no concession to me at all in that moment, which was really, really freaked me out internally. But there was that feeling that Subhuti describes, that anything could happen, and a kind of wild, untrammeled quality. And I don't mean by that Bhante could have gone up and done a dance or something like that. I don't mean that at all. That this was somebody, I don't know what the word is, authentic. These words are so cheap and through overuse, aren't they? But just, he was just there, you know. And we were sitting there, I don't know how long for, and I was feeling increasingly awkward. And it kind of got exploded, this feeling, because he leaned over to this jar of incense sticks and started to clean his ears with them. Which I think is something that happened. I mean, when I went to India, people do that quite often in public for your ears. So he was cleaning his ears. What was interesting was my first thought. It was literally, God, what would Mum say? So clearly a teaching. Everything was a teaching in those days. He was just being Bhante completely. Later on, I had my first. Having said that about that encounter and very kind of cryptic communications, you know, I was a pretty obnoxious young Buddhist who could quote the survey and Buddhist scriptures at order members. I thought Subhuti was probably the same as the Arahant in The Perfection of Wisdom, and would try and talk to him about the perfection of wisdom and things like that. And I think I thought all of the members were bodhisattvas. I thought if they had those names, they must be bodhisattvas. So I talked to them as if they knew all about, you know, the Dharma, which I think for some of them was a little bit frightening and irritating, frankly. But I'd have these cryptic conversations with Banti about the perfection of wisdom and things like that. But the main thing was he was very encouraging. I'd write letters to him and get replies, go to see him in his place in Norfolk, and he would just delight at my wonder. I'd want him to tell me about his teachers and the tankers in his room, and he'd just grin and laugh and so on. So there was both the sort of this very plain, unadorned, completely himself kind of quality, and this also equally himself, this delighted, encouraging quality. Just a heads up for the younger people here. When Banti told me he would ordain me, he was so happy telling me that he was going to ordain me. He was grinning away at my slight embarrassment that he'd told me. So he just said, by the way, I've decided to ordain you. And then he said, young people have a lot to offer the movement. Young was, in those days, 18, 19. Old was, I think, late 20s in those days. So things had changed. But this delight. So there's that side, but then there's this other side. And it's interesting, at the time, I always found it very, very difficult. But in some ways, it's the things, as well as the encouragement and the delighting in, because I definitely felt delighted in by Banti, there was this very, well, Vajra-like quality. I remember my Mitra ceremony, and in those days you had two Kalyana Mitras. I don't know if Banti was tired or what was going on. There he was in his robes. I had Buddhadasa and Visantara either side of me, my two Kalyana Mitras. It was at the end of a long sequence of Kalyana Mitra ceremonies he'd done. He gave this little discourse in the ceremony, and he said, becoming a Mitra is like joining a dance. You've been watching the dance from the outside, but now you're going to make some steps. Everything's been thought, everything's been said, everything's been felt. Now's the time for action. Now's the time to join the dance. Maybe one day you'll get to the centre of the dance, but you're not in the dance yet. This is your first action. And he went on and on about action, action, action. And he wasn't smiling. I felt I was being told off. And afterwards, Visantara said, he didn't say or talk like that to anybody else, which made me feel even worse. But there was this quality of very direct communication and completely irresistible, even though I found those difficult communications difficult, uncomfortable. I felt very self-conscious, very thrown back on myself. I was like, to use the Sufi metaphor, like the proverbial moth being drawn towards the flame. I just could not, I could not move away from Banti. And I suppose it kind of gets summed up at my ordination, which I probably recall every day. It was a weekend retreat in a forest in Suffolk, and Banti appeared, not just wearing his robes, but wearing this high-collared orange-gold Tibetan shirt, and he had his beads, and Loka Mitra had never seen Banti dressed like this. He said, oh, Banti, you look fantastic. And Banti looked at me and said, well, as Richard is into things Tibetan, I thought I'd better dress up. With his eyebrows going up and down and sort of looking at me, and me feeling increasingly self-conscious and extremely sort of, virginal, I suppose. Something like that. And in the ordination itself, it's very simple. But I feel that in that moment, Banti gave me absolutely everything that I need. And there was a real charge to that communication. I mean, years and years later, Banti talks about ordination as a witnessing of going for refuge, going for refuge, witnessing going for refuge. And I know sometimes older order members felt that, oh, well, wasn't it initiation? Of course, to be witnessed is an initiation. It is a when there's a real witnessing, when there's real communication, energy, tremendous energy is released, forces are released. And, you know, the sadhana, the mantra I was given, the name I was given. If in a sense Bhante had given me nothing else, I didn't know this at the time because I wanted many, many more things afterwards. I got very, very greedy. But actually, if there was nothing else, there was a kind of essentialized communication or whatever of the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. Everything actually, you know, was involved. Everything was there in that moment. I really firmly believe that. And that business of Bhante wearing robes, the long hair, the beads, and knowing as well that Bhante was definitely not a conventional Buddhist monk, that knowing from friends that they had all sorts of encounters and communication with Bhante. But that particular image of Bhante is extremely important to me. Not just because that's how he dressed when he ordained me, but it kind of is a kind of clash of different dimensions. Subhuti evoked Bhante's traditionalism. He's a real traditionalist. And yet there's that quality of going beyond whatever's, you know, whatever's stuck, whatever's conventional. And years later, Aloka painted, we've got one of these paintings at Padmaloka of Bhante in robes and long hair. It's very, very important to me, very important for, it kind of points to something beyond itself for me, this kind of combination of, he's not a conventional Buddhist monk, yet he's wearing monastic robes. And thinking about that, when I was selecting bits and pieces, there's a couple of things I think it's important to read from the poems. I'm going to give you the handouts later. There's two. There's one that he wrote in the early days of the movement, a poem, which I really associate with this aspect of Bhante. It's called "I Want to Break Out." I want to break out. Batter down the door. Go tramping black heather all day on the windy moor. And at night, in hayloft or under hedge, find a companion suited to my mind. I want to break through. Shatter time and space. Cut up the void with a knife. Pitch the stars from their place. Nor shrink back when, lidded with darkness, the eye of reality opens and blinds me, blue as the sky. And years later, he wrote a poem called "People Like Things Labeled," and I think this is such an important poem when you, if you think about Bhante, if you reflect on Bhante. So, "People Like Things Labeled." People like things labeled. They want to know if you are fish, flesh, fowl, or good red herring. In particular, they want to know if you are a bad red herring. Thus it was that they asked me if I was a monk or layman, meaning really if I was chaste or unchaste. I pointed skyward, saying, "The stars belong to the sky, but the names Orion, Andromeda, Great Bear, they belong to the earth." They replied, "You are being evasive. We knew it all along. You're a bad red herring." And they threw me back into the sea, where I swam happily with the other bad red herrings. The loss was theirs. So I think there's that. There's also Bhante's tremendous energy that Subhuti referred to. This tremendous energy of communication. So it's not just, you know, and I think that energy kind of breaks all those boundaries. You used to hear it in those old lectures. They've probably been tidied up now by Chandradas, I should think. But you could actually hear him banging the lectern in the old lectures and the microphone shaking. I mean, this was listening to it on an old clunky reel-to-reel, and yet you felt the urgency of the communication. And those Bodhisattva Ideal lecture series, the Tantric Path, and so on. Even the Eightfold Path is tremendous energy. I think it was Pragnanata said that she thought that Bhante's communication in India was what?
Demonic.
It's just tremendous energy of the Dharma. So there is that poem as well, which Subhuti quotes in the Suprapersonal Force, called The Wind. I'll just read it to you just to remind you of that. A wind was in my sails. It blew stronger and fiercer hour by hour. I did not know from whence it came or why. I only knew its power. Sometimes it dashed me on the rocks. Sometimes it spun me round and round. Sometimes I laughed aloud for joy. Sometimes I felt a peace profound. It drove me on, that manic wind, when I was young. It drives me still now I am old. It lives in me. Its breath, my breath. Its will, my will. Yeah, so this tremendous energy of Bhante. Again, I kind of, another thing I didn't mention when I was a lot younger. There's that, and then there's this incredible tenderness. Again, before I was ordained, I'd gone to Brighton with Bhante for various reasons. I was living in London then. And that's right, it was the time in Brighton that he told me that he would ordain me. And we travelled back on the last train to London, a stopping train from Brighton to London. This is back in the 1970s. I think you came and met us at Victoria Station to drive us back to Sukhavati. And Bhante had been to the bookshops, the second-hand bookshops, because Bhante loved second-hand bookshops, and Brighton at that time had lots of them. And he wasn't in the mood to talk. He'd been very active during this period. So he handed me a book and said, "Well, read that." And so, okay, you know. So I'm sitting opposite him, and I read, and I just fell asleep. I just dozed off. And every so often, I woke up into this half sleep. And Bhante wasn't reading. He was sitting on the edge of his seat opposite me, and he was looking at me with this delighted and delightful grin that was also incredibly wicked. So the whole journey was me dozing off, coming to this this look. Very tender. And there was this very weird feeling that I was being seen very deeply, and probably being seen more clearly while I was asleep than while I was awake. Very, very strange. But this tenderness, this benign quality, but also this quality of, again, what's going to happen? Anything could happen, because you don't often have somebody kind of looking at you with such attention, asleep or awake. Certainly, it's the first time I'd experienced it. I want to quote from Lama Govinda this business about the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. It's from a book called A Living Buddhism in the West. And Lama Govinda says, entering a guru-chela relationship, chela meaning disciple, entering a guru-chela relationship is neither a matter of intellect nor a hasty emotional reaction. Only when both guru and chela intuitively feel in advance the inner bond of feeling and thinking will any fruitful work be possible. The relationship can only become fully effective if it is sparked by the flashing forth of that all-maturing cosmogonic eros that introduces and continuously supports the process of spiritual transformation. So it's only effective, the guru-disciple relationship, and I would say perhaps even the Kalyana-Mitra relationship too. It's only can only become fully effective if it is sparked by the flashing forth of that all-maturing cosmogonic eros that introduces and continuously supports the process of spiritual transformation. So the flashing forth of that all-maturing cosmogonic eros. Like I say, I did tap in cosmogonic eros into Google, and I got hymns from Gnosticism, which I couldn't really understand. But my understanding of it, such as it is, and it's limited, that I think what's being said here is that eros, the love, the passion, creates a cosmos, creates the cosmos. And it's that creation of that cosmos that matures us and continuously supports us. Like I say, at my ordination, it was all there. I definitely would characterise my ordination as that the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros was activated. I don't think Banti went into the ordination thinking, I'm going to flash forth the cosmogonic eros. It's something that happened in the communication. Something flashed forth that was in a sense complete, but needed unfolding and maturing. And in that unfolding and maturing, it would lead to the unfolding and maturing of me. But it wasn't, of course, simply personal to me, because after the private ordination, there was a public ordination. And I remember my public ordination. It was midsummer, June 1976, an incredibly hot summer. And there was just so much love at the public ordination. I was ordained with Ratnaguna. And, I mean, Banti was really inspired by us both, I think, and by everybody there. And I remember when he talked about our names, saying that when people say our names, they should see lotuses unfolding and vajras descending. And when they say Ratnaguna's name, they should just see jewels, you know, manifesting in the space around. Really wonderful. And so much love from other people. And he did this seminar on this weekend retreat on the Shepherd's Search for Mind. It's absolutely wonderful, thrilling seminar where, yeah, a pointing out happened. Banti was talking about the pointing out instruction and commenting on Milarepa teaching this young shepherd about the nature of consciousness. And I remember this wonderful moment. I didn't really understand what was happening at all, but I suddenly said, when Banti was getting us to look at our minds, I said, so you're saying that we can't know the mind? He said, exactly, you can't know the mind. And I remember, I didn't know what that meant, but I was utterly thrilled, utterly uplifted and inspired. And there was this mood of tremendous inspiration. Yes, it was from Banti, but I think Banti was sparked off by all of us on that weekend retreat. And who else knows what forces, the text, the Dharma? It was all in play. So much love, actually. And after I was ordained, he sent me a postcard to instruct me, and Banti had very, very neat, very precise handwriting, and he was instructing me, because I'd decided to transcribe this seminar, and he made it very clear in this postcard that he sent me, make sure you transcribe every word, everything, you know. And it was like, oh, right, okay. But the card was really interesting. It was a painting by Magritte, of a blue sky with a golden apple, a red apple, and a blue apple just floating in this blue sky. And the painting was called First Love. And in those days, when you got a postcard from Banti, there was always we all thought there was a message, perhaps even if there wasn't. But the message seemed to be very clear. And then he said at the end of his message, what a perfect weekend. And there was this sense, there was both a message, look, this is your first love. That was the way I took it. But also, make sure it's your first love. That was the point, that was the teaching. So love was very strongly in the air, and has certainly been, you know, a very, very big theme for me ever since, which perhaps talk about later on in the retreat. But of course, this flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros is public in another way. Because it's you know, getting ordained is entering a sangha, an order, a spiritual community, a movement. You know, Banti talked about the movement in those days, and he liked the word movement because he said it connotes, you know, something really that you get, something you get a charge from, like electricity. That's what he wanted. He wanted people to, when they encounter our spiritual community, there's a very definite encounter. You get a shock, even. That's definitely the way he used to talk. So it's about not just about a personal practice, it's about living a life with others. And again, Bhante created a cosmos, a world for us, out of love, I would say. Out of a love that is perhaps not his. It is that supra-personal force, that love of the Dharma, love of the Buddha, love of the Sangha. I don't know really what you call it. But I'm thinking of some of those lecture series that he did. I've mentioned things like, you know, the Tantric Path and so on, but there are others a bit later, like the Sutra of Golden Light, given in Hampstead Town Hall. Transformation of life and world in the Sutra of Golden Light. The Vimalakirti Nidesha, which is all about working together to build a Buddha land, and so on. Subhuti last night mentioned the seminars, lots of personal conversations. He's talking, if you like, into existence, not just using, you know, in a way he's doing prophecy, I feel, when Bhante speaks in some of these things. The word is creative. The word is powerful. And Adhisthana is an expression of the word. It comes out of his, you know, vision, and it comes out of his communication and interaction with his disciples, the people that have followed and done so much to create physically these different worlds, environments in which we can live. Do you remember that poem about what he thought the FWBO, as it was called, was giving the world? Well, he gave a lecture series on it. That's the sort of program, Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow. But listen to the poem. Listen to the poem called Four Gifts. I come to you with four gifts. My first gift is a lotus flower. Do you understand? My second gift is a golden net. Can you recognize it? My third gift is a shepherd's round dance. Do your feet know how to dance? My fourth gift is a garden planted in a wilderness. Could you work there? These are my four gifts. Dare you accept them? So yes, Bhante's words are more than words. They're we're inspired by them, roused by them, urged by them, challenged by them. And as I said, out of those words, there's been the emergence of worlds, cosmoses, if you like. They've bodied forth in buildings. You know, felt that very, very strongly in the building of the old fire station, or the conversion of the old fire station into Sakhavati in the London Buddhist Centre. You know, all the different centres that have started, the livelihoods, and so on and so forth, all from this, yes, let's call it the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. But it isn't, in the end, about those worlds and those environments, those structures, though they are incredibly important. And I think that it's very easy to take these environments, institutions for granted. They are extraordinarily supportive of a Dharma life, but they're only animated by people, by us being alive with this quality, this eros, this quest for the beautiful. I remember a lecture, again another early lecture, about, I think he might have given it in New Zealand, about what the movement is, and he said something like, he talked about, yes, the movement has grown. And I don't mean by that, yes, there are more centres, but he said more and more people, more and more individuals are committing themselves to the life, to the Dharmacharya, to living themselves to the life with one another. That's the really crucial thing. Although, I don't want to undermine these wonderful environments they have, but they live depending on how we live. In a way, how much we love and cherish and value what we do. I'll end with another poem of Bhante's about this, just staying with this theme of worlds coming into existence from communication, from words, from the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. It's a a poem written, I think, certainly in, either in the very early days of the movement or before it. It's called New. I should like to speak with a new voice. Speak like Adam in the garden. Speak like the rishis of old, announcing in strong, jubilant voices the sun, moon, stars, dawn, winds, fire, storm, and above all the God-given, intoxicating, ecstatic soma. Speak like divine men celebrating the divine cosmos with divine names. I should like to speak with a new voice, telling the new things that I know, chanting in incomparable rhythms new things to new men, singing the new horizon, the new vision, the new dawn, the new day. I should like to use new words, use words pristine, primeval, words pure and bright as snow crystals, words resonant, expressive, creative, such as breathed to music, built Ilion. The old words are too tired, soiled, stale, lifeless. New words come to me from the stars, from your eyes, from space. New words vibrant, radiant, able to utter the new me, able to build for new men a new world.